He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
Telling it like it is. Giving you both sides of the story. This is Katz at Night.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now, here's John Katzimatidis.
Well, we're back. It's Katz at Night. And again, TGIF, Dental Audit Friday. And in the studio with us is Ed Cox, 10 years chairman of the New York State Republican Party. And I'd like to hear what he has to say about a few things of ethics that's going on with Rudy Giuliani. And Lydia Serrani is here, and Governor Patterson is on the phone. And I think we have a guest on coming in.
We have John Solomon. He's a world-renowned investigative journalist. He's been everywhere, and now he has his own website, justthenews.com, where he specializes in breaking exclusive stories. Welcome, John.
Great to be with you. Happy Friday.
Happy TGIF. Thank God it's Friday.
I'll drink to that.
Yeah. I mean, the government just broke the UFO report 5 minutes ago. A half hour ago, whatever, and it's the same BS as always. Well, it may be from outer space. We're not sure who they are, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, we've seen this story several times before, and my guess is we'll see it several times again. You know, we do know that there have been increasing numbers of unusual object sightings and sightings that can't be explained.
Slight things like turning off nuclear weapons at nuclear sites, et cetera, things like that. Some slight things.
Just little stuff.
Nothing big. Yeah. So, but, you know, I think a lot of the things that there'd be, some of the people I talk to in the intelligence community tell me that one of the phenomenon they're looking at is the possibility that this is psyops, that some of these images that pilots may have seen may actually be like holographs that are used, designed to confuse a pilot or to create illusions in the sky. And so that's an interesting area. It's not mentioned in the report, at least not that I saw in the first round, but I am extremely interested.
Yeah, but those illusions in the sky don't turn off nuclear weapons.
Well, that's true. Those would be other potential causes. But I do think that some of these objects that have dipped and made these really amazing fast-changing paths that defy physics. I think there's some work in the intelligence community to try to see if that may be some form of psyop warfare. So it'll be interesting to see if our enemies are behind some of it. And then there's still the unknown, which we've been dealing with since Roswell.
Now,
John,
yes, Governor.
I was just going to say, this is David Patterson, John. My question is, there seems to be a policy that must be coming from the military, because the president of the United States, when President Carter ran for president in 1976, he said he wanted to get to the bottom of this. After 1980, when he came out, he, to this day, he's 96 years old, has never said another word about UFOs.
They told him to shut up and don't even open his mouth again.
Right.
Yeah.
President Nixon had an interest as well. He was quiet.
Well,
Nixon's
son-in-law is sitting here in the studio, and Ed Cox, what do you have to say?
Well, I'm not sure that's why he went to China, but but you know, he didn't know. People don't know.
Sometimes they tell presidents, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah,
and we just told the story before. One of the reasons Marilyn Monroe might have been murdered is because supposedly it was thought that John Kennedy said the wrong things to her and she threatened to talk about it.
That could be.
Wow. Well, that happened with, remember, with Dick Morris when there were, this wasn't UFOs, but it was information about the space program that he told to a woman who then outed him, and that's how he lost his job at the time.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. What big news do you have today, John Solomon?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. The Justice Department has sued to challenge Georgia's voting integrity law, saying that it disenfranchises African-American and minority voters. That is going to set up a case that I'm pretty certain will make it all the way to the Supreme Court. And we'll find out if things like voter ID are considered by the courts to be disenfranchising or common sense securities. I think that moment today starts a process that could ultimately lead to an epic decision in the court
John,
system.
That's got to be a losing case. I mean, that's you being pushed for political purposes. In the end, I think that boomerangs.
There's no. I think that's right. Yeah. Listen, the American people.
I'm going to ask
polling.
Governor Patterson, as a member of the black community, Governor Patterson, are the Democrats saying that the black people are not smart enough to get voter ID?
Well, I think what they're saying is that this additional step beyond what existed before had political purposes to it, and that's something the court will have to resolve. Now, voter suppression in the black community is historic in this country, and so it is a premise that could have weight at the Supreme Court level. However, you have to get your ID to do a lot of things. Right now, you have to get you have to prove that you're vaccinated to get into places. Government can do that from time to time to ensure some public safety in the case of the coronavirus, and then just public integrity in the case of the vote. So I think it'll be close. I tend to think that the suit will lose, but it's a situation where the people who are bringing the case are very sensitive based on past discrimination in this area.
Understood. John Solomon, continue. You're the call in. You're supposed to give us the hot news today.
Let me see if I can deliver. Well, Derek Chauvin, the officer that was at the heart of the George Floyd murder, got 22 and a half years in prison. It seems that most sides are satisfied that that brings to close a case that has created a year of tumult and resurrected an entire debate about race in America and police and law enforcement tactics in America. So we have some closure on that case today. And then I'm going to take you someplace where I think is going to be low riding for a while, and then I think it's going to crop up and be something very important. In Georgia last night, before the Justice Department did its thing against the new law, a state judge did something very interesting. As you know, there's been an audit going on, and in that audit, a private lawyer has been allowed to look at the absentee ballots and start to determine if there was any unusual behavior. We now have access to a document that showed that the Secretary of State of Georgia had 29 pages of reports of irregularities in Atlanta. But what the judge did last night is Fulton County, Atlanta, came and said, listen, we have immunity under the Georgia Constitution, and therefore you can't sue us, and this lawsuit is moot. And the judge said, you know what, county, you do have immunity, but the people who work for the county don't. And so he added the names of all the top election officials on his own to the lawsuit and said, county, you're dismissed. You individuals who actually ran it, you still have personal liability. And he allowed the suit to go on. What does that mean? It means that beyond the audit, some of those people almost certainly will be put under oath, and we'll get answers under oath to many of the pressing questions about what goes on in some of these big urban voting centers. Are there irregularities? Are there unusual things, or are they all just conspiracy theories? I think that Georgia lawsuit is going to be the one to watch. Everyone's focused on Arizona, but keep an eye on that Georgia lawsuit. I think there's going to be some interesting developments.
So, John, what do you think? Look, former President Trump thinks a lot about the Arizona lawsuit. He's going to be a game changer in August. Yeah. What do you think?
You know, I like to keep an open mind, right? I haven't seen as much visibility into Arizona because they haven't released many of the findings. I think Georgia gives us real facts now. We now know in the Georgia case, because of the documents that the Secretary of State released, that there were double scanning of ballots, that ballots were transported in an insecure way, that people's names were exposed to the vote counters as they were counting. And we can go through all 29 pages. It's jaw-dropping. We know that at least in Atlanta, there was such a sloppiness that it could have led to misvoting or misconduct or miscounting or just bad procedures. We don't know what we know in Arizona yet. I know the president's put a lot of emphasis on that. I haven't seen much visibility to what they're finding. There are hints of it. But Georgia is something that we're getting real facts, real data, real specific information. And here's the thing I think will happen. I predict in the next few weeks you may see the Secretary of State in Georgia take over Fulton County's next election, say that it's so poorly run. It was so poorly run in November that the state is going to run the county election for the next year until the county can get its business together. That would be a dramatic moment. Maybe you'd see a second Justice Department intervention at that point. But I think Georgia is going to bubble up and be more impactful before the Arizona audit comes out in August.
Wow.
Governor Patterson, I wanted to get your reaction on the Derek Chauvin sentencing, 22 and a half years, 10 years more than normally, but because the judge said there was aggravating circumstances, he tacked on another 10 years.
Well, it wasn't 10 years more than normally. Oh. Normally, that was the prescription. That was the least amount that you could get. Mm. This, I thought, was completely appropriate. In other words, there was no reason to sentence him to 40 or 30 years. There was certainly no reason to sentence him to 12 years where he'd be out at a point that he could still live a productive life while George Floyd is lying in the grave. And that's really usually our general points of view about people who are convicted of second-degree murder, that they really should get either life without parole or some long sentence because
Guys,
the family...
He was guilty. David Patterson, he was guilty. 9.5 minutes on his neck is not warranted by anyone.
John, what I think we need right now is for more occasions where all of us on both sides of the aisle agree, and then I think we'll build back confidence and trust in each other, because this was an obvious case. I mean, I couldn't actually see this, but what everybody always says to me is the look on his face is just so disjointed at the time that he's sitting on this guy, and he put his other officers in danger because now they are going to be charged as accessories. But he was the senior officer.
If
there,
I was there, somebody should have pushed him off.
From Chauvin's point, the question is, he's going to appeal, right? And, John, do you think that on appeal he could get another trial in another jurisdiction on the grounds that in Minneapolis, if the jurors, everyone knew if it went the other way, Minneapolis would have been trashed completely?
You know, it'll be very interesting to see if that argument flies with the judges. This judge ran a pretty tight trial. Yeah. I mean, I watched a lot of trials. I thought he ran a pretty tight trial and kept things moving in a way that most appellate and Supreme Courts are going to look at favorably. But, you know, there may be some things. Maybe we'll learn something from the jurors. There was certainly the question of the one juror in the case. Let's see what happens. But I think that, you know, my impression of watching it is the judge was really running this on a tight ship, and that often is looked upon favorably by the appeals courts as a reason not to overturn.
I'm absolutely sure that this verdict will not be overturned, because where would you go in the United States to have another trial where they didn't know exactly the facts that exist in this case?
Governor Patterson, I will give you an instance. The jury was scared to walk out of the courthouse because outside the courthouse there was hundreds and hundreds of demonstrators that would have cut their throat if they would have said anything else but guilty.
Well, but John, that would have happened anyway, place where they held the trial, because many of those people protesting weren't even from Minneapolis.
Somebody gives them plane tickets to go from city to city. You're right. And I call upon the FBI to investigate them. You know, we investigate UFOs. Let's investigate the town-by-town terrorists that fly from city to city to terrorize the citizens of that city.
Now, the Department of Justice is too busy suing Georgia over voter ID laws instead of trying to figure out where all these Antifa and BLM protesters are coming from.
This is probably a very much minority opinion that I have, but I think that situations – such as what John described, but also January 6th, there were a lot of people in that crowd who don't care one way or the other, but really are trying to destroy the country. In other words, they have infiltrated the rallies on both sides.
Governor,
and
look
made
at
them
the videos.
When they otherwise wouldn't have been.
Look at the videos. What? Some of them, you know, there was no protection of the Capitol. They opened up the doors and just about welcomed them in.
Well, some of them went in and just stood there and protested.
There was not a single gun. And the FBI admits this. There was not a single gun. John Solomon, you're one of the most knowledgeable guys. You tell us.
Well, that's putting a lot of credit in me. Yes, listen, I think the FBI did say there were no guns. Later, the Justice Department came back and said there were two guns on the Capitol complex. That doesn't mean in the building, but maybe around it. this was not an armed insurrection by any means. There's very little arms. There were much more armaments used against NYPD officers in some of those early Antifa protests where you saw Molotov cocktails being thrown into squad cars, into squad SUVs. And so, you know, there's clearly a difference. And I'll tell you the thing that sticks in my mind that is the most unexplained moment. It was released by Senator Ron Johnson about 3 weeks ago. The security footage where people are walking in with the cops just watching. They're not holding the line. And I still have a question. Why did that happen?
Right. Absolutely. Great questions there. Thank you so much, John Solomon. David, Governor Patterson, stay on the line. When we come back, we have our own financial guru in the house, Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Talk Radio 77 WABC.
This is John Katzmatidis. We are back and with Lydia Serrani and Ed Cox. And I understand on the line we have the country's number one economist in my book. We have Larry Kudlow. How are you, Larry?
Hey, John. Fine. Great. Thank you.
Tell us, what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you, the big event this week was Joe Biden bait and switch, double cross on the bipartisan infrastructure gang, especially the five Republicans, who were negotiating in good faith, and they reached a deal with the White House, and they met with Biden yesterday, Thursday afternoon, to sign the deal. They went out and announced it in front of everybody, and then 1 hour later, Biden shows up in the White House and makes an announcement that the infrastructure deal has to be linked to the rest of their utopian, crazy, green workers' paradise ideas of another $3 trillion in spending, $3 trillion in tax increases, Green New Deal, end fossil fuel energy, and greatly damage the American economy. I mean, he said one thing, John, and then an hour later says another, which shows, you know what, Bernie Sanders and AOC really are running the White House with their crazy ideas. And the Republicans are absolutely furious, as they should be. And I'll tell you something. We got hold of the notes from Senator Rob Portman, who was a key guy. Portman, a very smart guy and a guy of principle, I might add. And he's got notes. He says the framework includes no income taxes, no changes to the 2017 tax bill, responsible pay-fors, and finally, solely core infrastructure priorities, not human infrastructure. Those were the notes he took from the agreement they reached Thursday afternoon and announced in front of the nation. And then Biden goes back into the White House and an hour later reneges and said, whoops, we won't pass this infrastructure package unless we have the rest of the $3 trillion in spending and the $3 trillion in tax hikes and all of the new entitlement transfer payments that will do so much damage to work and welfare dependency and family unity. I mean,
Larry, Ed Cox here, do you think he got slammed by his hard left in that hour between the doing the deal and making the second announcement that he needs both bills or he's not going to sign the deal?
It's possible. I mean, you could sort of imagine him going back to the Oval and then having a conference call with Sanders and AOC and Nancy Pelosi yelling at him, you did the wrong thing. You've got to go and make a new announcement. We are not going to pass this infrastructure bill unless we have all of our spending and tax increases. But, I mean, I don't know that. All I'm saying is it was an absolute bait and switch, an absolute double cross. And the thing is, it's not going to help him. Okay, it's going to make Biden look really bad. Republicans are furious. There are moderate Democrats who signed on to this thing, like, for example, Sinema of Arizona. They thought they had a deal, and now he's saying they don't have a deal. I mean, I have got Portman's notes, and I'm reading this. Solely core infrastructure, not human infrastructure, and no income taxes, no changes to the 2017 Trump tax cut bill. So,
and if there's and Larry, if there's anyone with really real integrity in the Senate, it's Senator Portman, and he's not running for office again. There's no reason why he would do anything but tell you exactly what the truth was.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, they thought this was good faith, and the thing is, they were, you know, yesterday afternoon, they were negotiating directly with the president. And then they go out in front of the West Wing, in front of the mics, what we call the sticks, and they make their announcement to the assembled political reporters, which means the rest of the world. And Biden, you know, says, yeah, fine, they're all slapping each other's back. There's a great picture of Biden slapping Portman's back. Yeah. It's fantastic. And then an hour later, he completely changes.
Do you think this administration is crumbling in this way? They just lurch one way and lurch the other. You know, they were for the funding the police. Now they're they want to fund the police. They were talk about systemic racism, and now they're New York's not the United States is not racist. They were hitting voter IDs before. Now they think voter IDs are just fine. I mean. Is this administration crumbling under the weakness of the president?
I don't want to stray too far off this particular topic. I mean, I think it's a very far-left administration, and I think it's run by the very far-left of the Democratic Party. And I think Eric Adams winning the Democrats in New York City for mayor is a very good sign, at least on the question of law and order. But in politics, in government, let me say in government, listen, I've been there. You can't do what Biden did and not escape the political consequences.
Exactly.
So actually, I would tell you that this tactic he's employed of bait and switch is going to wind up hurting them. And here's something else that's very, very important. You can talk about reconciling $3 trillion in spending and $3 trillion in tax hikes and the Green New Deal and all the rest of the what I call pre-Berlin Wall Bulgarian workers' paradise utopia. You can talk about that all you want, but they don't have a budget resolution. You have to get a resolution through the Senate and House budget committees. All of the relevant spending committees have to come up with their ideas and channel them through, and then they try to construct a reconciliation package between the two houses. They don't have that. They're nowhere near that.
So we're in no man's land.
It's going to take months for this to get done. By the way, I think it's why the stock market rallied today big time, because it's a step back from this crazy, you know, anti-growth, anti-investment, anti-free enterprise agenda they have. They think they got ground. I'm telling you, they lost ground in full public view.
Wow. Wow. So we're in no man's land right now, and we don't know which way we're going, except I guess the greatest thing that could happen right now is impasse, because what the Democrats are asking for is a little bit of craziness.
Craziness. And Democrats who are involved in this infrastructure deal are going to be pretty damn annoyed, because they went out on a limb, as did the Republicans. They went out on a limb. I mean, you got Portman, and you got Bill Cassidy, and you got Susan Collins, and so forth. And on the other side, you've got Sinema and Manchin and a few others. That's why this is going to be so hard for them. Now, Biden calls Senator Sinema of Arizona, Democrat, today to try to hustle her in support of this linkage between the infrastructure deal and the rest of their crazy spending and taxing agenda. But I guarantee you, she is not going to flinch. She put herself on a line. I think even Manchin, who is less trustworthy, is going to have a big problem with this. I mean, you just can't. This is like sophomoric stuff. You can't get away with
it. It's certainly going to make it more difficult to reach any other agreements down the road when something like this happens.
Which is great. Which is great. Because, you know, David, in this game, no news is good news. No guess is good guess. No reconciliation is great reconciliation. I don't want them to do any of this stuff. I don't want them to transform the American economy. I want to improve the economy. I don't want to transfer the economy. I don't want to transform our social values, our history, our culture. I don't want to transform race relations into some divisiveness that we have today. And I sure as heck don't want to transform anti-growth, anti-investment, anti-worker. You know, the biggest beneficiaries of a low corporate tax are not rich people. They're the blue-collar middle class. 70% of the burden of the corporate tax falls on the blue-collar middle class. If you raise that, you are going to do great damage. And incidentally, a lot of these think tanks, Rice University, the Tax Foundation, the Penn-Wharton model, have shown how bad the economy would be if these crazy plans go through. When Trump's tax cut passed, this is why all the Republicans are united. Mitt Romney, everybody, Rob Portman, the cut in the corporate tax of 2017 led directly to the biggest increase in real worker wages in several generations and the lowest unemployment rates for minority groups and the drop in poverty. And these Republicans know that, and some of these Democrats know that. And Biden is trying to overturn it. If he does overturn it, it'll be a disaster. But the great part about this is going to make it harder and it's to overturn. And that's why I go back to Rob Portman's notes. I'm looking right. No income tax, semicolon. No changes to 2017 tax bill. And then solely core infrastructure priorities, not human infrastructure. So that tells you that they got screwed, but that's not going to help Biden. In the next few months, it's going to create a lot of bad feelings, a lot of divisions. You cannot trust him. It puts him right back in the box. And Pelosi and Schumer are going to make it even worse.
So what are the odds, Larry, that reconciliation does not take place? That would be huge if you think the odds are against it now. As you laid out, all the complications in getting there and after this kind of a wreckage in the Oval Office.
I think, right, you know, I've been pretty worried about it because they got reconciliation to pass the COVID relief bill in the winter, which I thought was a lousy bill, and, you know, with all those unemployment benefits. But I'm saying now it may be 50-50. It may be 50-50. It might even be better than 50-50 that the reconciliation can be defeated. And it isn't the reconciliation per se. That's a means to an end. It's the gigantic increase in social welfare entitlements a la Europe and taxes, tax hikes. The whole country will pay. It's not just rich people who are going to suffer. It's the blue-collar middle class. So in my mind, beating this is a terrific thing. And I think the stock market is telling you that. It's telling you that. The market had a great week this week. It's up 3.5%. The S&P is at a new record. The Dow was up 1,100 points this week. And it's saying, it's saying two things. Number one, the inflation is not going to happen. And number two, the tax hikes are not going to happen. How about
Larry, we got some breaking news coming in from Miami. We have to take a break. Thank you.
Breaking news, WABC.
Well, we have the mayor of Miami on the line with us. We have Francis Suarez. We know right now that at least four people dead in that horrific building collapse, 159 people unaccounted for in that 12-story residential building in Surfside, Florida, 55 of the building's 136 units collapse. I mean, this is incredible, Mayor Suarez. I mean, this building was only built in the early 80s, and the building I know had recently hired an engineer to undergo like a recertification process, but it almost looks like a bomb went off.
Mayor, how are we doing?
You know, it's an incredibly tragic scene. I was there this morning with our urban search and rescue team, which was deployed to help and assist Surfside. Surfside is a small city that is slightly to the north of Miami Beach, and they don't have their own fire department. They are under the fire department jurisdiction of Miami-Dade County. So Miami-Dade County has been taking a primary responsibility over the search and rescue efforts. This morning, they asked to deploy one of the federal relief teams, of which Miami is a large part of it. And so our team was activated and has been on the site since noon today. And it's just, you know, an incredibly terrible situation, particularly for the families. You know, the families are thirsting for information. They want to know what tactics are being employed to help save their loved ones. And it's an incredibly tragic scene. You know, the hope that we have stems from the fact that, you know, our urban search and rescue team has been in New York during 9/11. We've been to Haiti during the earthquake. We've been to the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian. And it's some of the best trained, if not the best trained, urban search and rescue teams in the world. So, you know, we're hopeful because we have seen situations in Haiti where buildings that have collapsed in a pancake style, similar to the one that collapsed in Surfside, we have been able to find survivors 72 hours after the incident. In the case of Haiti, we actually pulled five people out 72 hours after the wreckage. So we remain hopeful. We're taking a very methodical approach. Obviously, these first responders are risking their lives being in a site where, you know, two-thirds of the building essentially pancaked and came down in a very quick fashion. So it's just a very difficult situation. And our teams are there providing as much help as possible. And I went to the center, you know, where the families are to try to give them as much information as they could, because we really should prioritize them and make sure that they at least are knowing all of the different tools and tactics that we're using, from dogs to sonar technology to a pulse technology. We're using all kinds of different technologies. There's been multiple fires on the scene as well, as is typical in situations like this. So right now we're focusing all our efforts to assist the county in their search and relief efforts, with the hope that we're able to find survivors.
Mayor, it doesn't sound too good. 154 missing. I mean, what are the hopes of we'll ever get them back?
Well, like I said, you know, it's you know, I don't want to also give the family a false sense of hope. You know, what we're doing is methodical, going through the wreckage, which is a significant site, and there is some heavy machinery on the site right now. But we're taking it minute by minute and hoping that that there are survivors and that they were able to rescue them. We did. The Miami-Dade County Search and Rescue Team did rescue a young boy who was a 10th grader from the wreckage early. Unfortunately for him, his mother, I believe, was one of the ones that was confirmed deceased. So, you know, they're obviously suffering tremendously. And it just, I mean, look, I had to be there and I had to see the images and the pictures. I know people that were in the building. I have friends that know people that were in the building. Family members, a friend of mine, were in the building. So it's very tragic because it's a lot of people, and they're people that we know.
Mayor Suarez of Miami, do we know yet what caused the building to collapse like this? I mean, it's just incredible. I know there was some work being done.
Yeah. We don't know. What we do know is that all buildings in Florida have to go through what's called a 40-year certification. And, you know, oftentimes in the majority of those buildings, you know, all kinds of fixes need to be made, which usually costs millions of dollars to fix. And so, you know, that part of the investigatory process will, I'm sure, begin the minute that the search and rescue efforts end, which will be, you know, days from now. Because, as I've said, we have found in other circumstances survivors as far as 7 days after an initial collapse of this kind. So that's what we're focusing on right now. We're putting all our energy and efforts into that. And we're asking everyone to pray and I put on my social media some relief effort websites that people can visit. So I would urge people to go on my social media and look at that if they feel compelled to help. Those are ways that they can.
Is there any indication what went wrong? What happened?
There really isn't, other than the dramatic footage that we've seen, the videos that we've seen, which are extremely dramatic because they show a very clear picture of the building coming down rapidly, right? This doesn't seem to have been an event based on the images that we've seen, the video that we've seen, to be something that was, you know, that was something that happened in a slow fashion. It happened rather quickly. And so there were many people that were trapped in the building. And some of the stories that I've heard, you know, are people actually being rescued alive from the building, some people of which had to, you know, were on high floors and had to traverse those floors in an exposed fashion with, you know, 12 stories or 10 stories below them. And so there are many, many acts of heroism and bravery on the part of our first responders getting those people out, and on the part of residents who were obviously shocked and didn't even know what was going on. This happened in the middle of the night. This was about 1:30 in the morning. So, you know, it was a highly inhabited building, unfortunately. And it happened in the middle of the night, so the vast majority of the people that were living there were there.
Wow.
And again, we're speaking with the mayor of Miami, Mayor Suarez. It's just, when you look at some of the pictures and you see the family members of the victims are holding up, like, the pictures. Like, remember, it reminds you of 9/11, you know, yes. Where they're looking for their yeah. family members.
Absolutely.
Mayor Suarez, please go back to... You know, do whatever you can to save as many as you can. And thank you for calling in and letting all America know what's going on. And if there's any other news, please feel free to text me and let me know.
We will. Thank you so much for reaching out. And thank you for your prayers and your interventions. And again, I urge everyone to go to my social media and look at ways that they can be helpful. And in the meantime, you know, we want your help and your prayers because, you know, our first responders
give
are
us the social media. Give us a social media page.
Yeah, so it's at Francis Suarez is my Instagram. And I believe it's at Francis X Suarez is my Twitter handle, or at Francis Suarez is my Twitter handle. And at Miami Mayor or Mayor of Miami is my Instagram handle. So, you know, those are the places you can find. You could probably just search my name in Twitter and in Instagram, and it'll pop up.
Francis Suarez. Are,
mm-hmm. That's yes. right. FrancisSuarez. And I would just, again, you know, I want to thank you all for taking the time to understand what's happening here. And it is a tremendous tragedy, which has had, of course, state and national and international implications. So we're grateful for all of the support and the prayers that we've received.
Our prayers are with you. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have Ricky Kleeman, Commissioner Rick, Commissioner Bratton's wife, and tell us about
Derek Chauvin, the sentencing.
Let's take the break.
John Katz and the D's. 77 WABC.
Welcome back to the John Katzmatidis, Cats at Night Show. I'm Lydia Serrano here with John Katzmatidis and Ed Cox. Ed, you got a lot on your mind, huh?
Yeah, well, you bet. And I know we got Governor Patterson on here. Governor,
oh, yes.
you know what happens when an executive of a state or the president, and it begins to just be a wreckage. And I think that's what's going on here. The fact that we heard Larry Kudlow saying he had a deal. And the deal was in the notes of Senator Portman. It's absolutely clear it was a deal. And then an hour later, he says, no, I want my whole deal back. I need two bills. I need reconciliation.
That is shocking.
Same time. This is an administration that's going in the wrong direction.
And I think you remember I told you a story that when I became governor, I asked the two legislative leaders, Silver and Bruno, that we would resolve some of our differences, but let's get the budget passed on time. And they both agreed to it. And then on one Sunday morning when we were all supposed to meet, I found out that Silver was flying from Washington, D.C., and then back to New York to clock mileage for himself and take time away from passing the budget. But just one quick thing about what's going on in Miami, and that is, remember, we lost 2,700 lives in the attack on the country on September 11th. But what we don't think about that often is hundreds of those lives that were lost, the bodies were never recovered. And if they even got a slight DNA from anything, they counted it as a recovery. So I feel so sorry for those families because there are 159 people missing 36 hours after the catastrophe.
It's horrible.
There might be one or two, but there's very little chance that we're going to, I mean, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but in those situations, very rarely do you ever find maybe more than one or two people that survive.
Also on the line with us, we have Ricky Kleeman. Welcome, Ms. Kleeman.
Thank you.
A legal analyst, among many other accomplishments. You have a great book out. Well, your husband has a great book out.
Indeed, he does.
The Profession, which I just got a copy of, by the way. So I'm very
You'll
excited.
You'll enjoy
about.
It. It's really, I have to say, I understand I'm biased, but even if I attempt to be objective, it is really an extraordinary read.
Ricky Freeman,
sentencing. Derek Chauvin, 22 and a half years. You have covered numerous trials as a legal analyst yourself. What's your reaction?
Well, I covered the sentencing itself and have covered the Chauvin case since the time of the murder of George Floyd. And I think that any good legal analyst or academic should say that under the sentencing guideline grids of Minnesota, that 22 and a half years is a fair sentence under these circumstances. I know that many people in the community of Minneapolis will not be pleased with that sentence. They will not feel that it is enough because that they were looking for the maximum of 30 years under the guidelines. However, the judge wrote a 22-page memorandum to explain his reasoning. And what he did was he certainly looked at all of the parts of the sentencing guidelines, including the four aggravating factors that the prosecution had offered out of five. The judge accepted four, that it was an act of cruelty, that Derek Chauvin, the police officer, had abused his power, that the crime was committed in front of children, and that ultimately the crime was committed with three people or more. All of those factors under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines permit the judge to move away from the presumptive sentence of unintentional second-degree murder, which was what the jury found, of 12 and a half years, and to upwardly depart. And the judge came up with a sentence of 22 and a half years, which is almost double the presumptive sentence. So by any look at it, the sentence was hardly lenient, though some people will believe it wasn't strong enough. I've read the judge's memorandum now, and the reasoning is very, very sound.
Do you think this will help the country heal?
I don't know if ultimately a number in terms of a sentence helps the country heal. I mean, I think that the guilty verdict certainly had the opportunity or has the opportunity to help the country heal. The number itself, I do think that if it was something like probation, which the defense was asking for, which under the circumstances of this case would have been preposterous, or getting to the maximum, that those two extremes would not have helped in terms of any healing. But it's not about the number. It's really about police reforms, and the police would be the first people to tell you that the good police leaders have been reforming for decades, and that they continue to reform, and that no one really wants to work with somebody like a Derek Chauvin. People want to work with cops who are decent and caring and who obey their oath of taking care of people and protecting the public. So the problem we're having is, I think, in the country since certainly before the killing of George Floyd, but it was certainly shown after the murder of George Floyd that was televised, where we saw 9 minutes and 29 seconds of a slow motion homicide, that what people have been saying is that they want to be heard. The problem is, will they be able to hear one another? If you're not open to listening to the other side, if you're not open to sitting down with the other side, then you cannot heal. But certainly there are leaders on both sides of this divide in terms of issues of ferreting out bad cops and training cops in a better way. And those voices come from within the ranks of great police chiefs and beyond my bias of talking about my husband, let's look at the wonderful Art Acevedo, head of the Major City Chiefs, now the chief of police in Miami, having been the chief in Houston, amongst other cities that he's led. Art Acevedo has been leading the charge for years about seeing one another and listening to one another. And what we need are leaders from the left and leaders from the right to be able to have a conversation. Otherwise, we're just talking past each other.
Well, you know, Ricky, the thing that would probably be very important for all of us to understand is that the incidents of police officers who use excessive force or at times break the law themselves, and the people who live in different communities in even high crime areas, it's very few of the people who live there. It's very few of the police who serve them. If we could all ever figure out that it's very few people that have put too many of us in acrimonious positions, we'd do a lot better.
Ricky,
I agree with you.
I have to say, Ricky, thank you for calling in. We're out of time.
I'm sorry, John.
No, it's okay.
Thank you for calling in. You were fantastic. Governor Patterson, thank you. And Ed Cox, thank you for being in the studio with us. Lydia Serrani. And God bless New York and God bless America. Thank you for all tuning in.